From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, a sexual assault in high school. Years later, questions and scars remain. A federal judge rules that there are problems with the cash bail system in Dallas County. And a West Texas Help Wanted ad doesn't hold back. It tells applicants to get their act together.
I'm just not going to tolerate the foolishness that some of these people do.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. As the nation tries to determine the facts behind an alleged sexual assault that involves Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, and then see if the Republican-controlled Senate determines this to disqualify him for a lifetime position for the highest court in the nation, many people are saying these types of sexual assaults happen all the time. The Me Too movement has shined a light on sexual predators in our schools and workplaces, but decades before Me Too, and to some extent even today, there's that cover-up culture and blame the victim deflection. Washington Post opinion writer Elizabeth Brunig writes about an accusation of rape that happened at her high school in Arlington, Texas in 2006. A classmate of Brunig was sexually assaulted, and no one was ever prosecuted for it, but one person was punished, the victim. Brunig has been investigating the story for the last 3 years. She said she's always been haunted by what happened, why there was no accountability, and how these types of crimes happen frequently and little has changed. Be advised, there is a graphic description of the sexual assault in the interview.
It always sort of bothered me. It was a big deal. I think an important thing to acknowledge is it wasn't a tiny high school. You know, anybody in Texas is familiar with these big 1A schools. And that was what Martin was. So there were thousands of kids there. It was bigger than a lot of colleges. And, you know, when that many people are stirred up about something, it's hard not to notice it. And there was, you know, like it says in the story, there's spray painting on the wall about this girl. People wrote things on their cars about her. And people were yelling things at her in the hall. So it was hard to miss. And so with that much activity, it did strike me that something had happened. And I had just, at the time, accepted the narrative that was prominent at the time, which was that she had said something and then recanted and then taken it all back. But as I got older and started to reflect on it a little bit more as a more mature person, I wondered if that was really all there was to it. And so it bothered me in that way. You know, had I just sort of accepted a narrative because it was easy at the time, because that's what everyone else was saying, and gone along with something that I shouldn't have agreed with.
Walk me through what Amber says happened that night.
Amber, so she was at a party, and earlier in the day, she and the other Martin High School cheerleaders had been at a sort of kickoff party for the football season. The mascot of Martin High School, the Martin Warriors, so they called this war party. After that, a bunch of athletes and cheerleaders went to a local cheerleader's house for a pool party. And there, a bunch of kids had brought alcohol, and they started drinking. Amber shared alcohol with a bunch of kids, she says, and she got pretty drunk. She says that she called her mom and established that she could spend the night at her friend's house there, which made her feel comfortable she wouldn't have to drive herself home, though she had her car with her. So she felt comfortable getting, pretty inebriated. And then she says at some point in the night, probably around midnight when things were getting close to winding down, a couple of guys, both seniors, who she knew in passing but not very well, approached her and said they were going to go get food and asked if she would like to come with. And other kids had done that all night. You know, they'd gone off, they'd got food at, you know, Taco Bell, Jack in the Box, and then they'd come back to the party. So Amber didn't think anything of it. She said, sure, fine, yep. And so they got in one of the boys' trucks, and they left. And instead of going to get food, Amber says, they took her to a shed, which is on the rear of a property that belonged to another boy. And Amber says they told her that they were going to run up real quick and grab some beer, and they needed her to help them get it. So she went inside the shed with them. She was not very coordinated at this point, and she was trying to climb the ladder into the loft portion of the shed, and she fell, bloodying her elbow. They helped her up the ladder, she says, and when she got into the loft portion of the shed, Amber says they told her to take off her clothes. She said no, and then they started to take her clothes off of her and push her down, and then they raped her, both of them. That's what she says happened. After that, she says at some point she was able to roll away, and she was able to get her shirt and her athletic skirt back on. And at that point, she was able to demand to leave. And she was pretty bruised at that point, and they took her back to the party. At this point, the party had wound down. So a few kids and the homeowner were standing in the driveway, Amber says, and that she immediately approached two kids, a boy and a girl, and the homeowner, and told them she had just been raped. She says the homeowner took her upstairs and told her to go to sleep, and that's what she did.
She went to the police. She did go to the police the next day.
Right. I mean, you know, one of the big questions that I think a lot of folks have reading this is why didn't the homeowner call the police right then and there when Amber reported that she had just been raped? You know, because it's not just Amber who says she told the homeowner that night. It's another student who was present, one of the boy who was present, who says that Amber told the homeowner she was raped. And so, you know, it's very questionable why that adult didn't call the police right then and there, but she didn't. And so for that reason, it wasn't until the next morning when Amber got up, drove herself home, and then immediately told her mother she was raped, that Amber went to the hospital, received a sexual assault exam, and made her report to the police. At that time, Amber received an exam. The sexual assault nurse examiner, who I spoke to for this article, did complete her exam. She recovered DNA from one of the boys who Amber accused. And that was semen, and she also recorded some tearing to Amber's vagina and anus, and also bruising all over Amber's body that was consistent with Amber's story. When I asked the sexual assault nurse examiner, who had done, of course, dozens of these specialized sexual assault exams, you know, what was your impression of her injuries? The nurse said that girl was raped. I mean, she could tell from her injuries. She felt like what she was looking at was the result of a forcible rape.
So we're talking about a rape that happened to a high school girl at a high school party in 2006 in Arlington, Texas, at the same high school that you went to, although you were a couple of years, you were a sophomore at the time, and you witnessed the basically the high school turning on the girl, Amber Wyatt, and so what did they painted faith? Faith was painted everywhere. What did faith mean?
Right. And so faith, you know, initially, I think what was told to teachers was that, oh, it just means that we, the students, have faith that everything is going to turn out all right. We have faith in the boys. But it was actually an acronym. And what the kids all told each other it meant was the F word. F Amber in the head, or F Amber in three holes. You know, these nasty acronyms. You know, it's probably worth mentioning that kids who wrote that on their cars would not have copped to saying that it meant that. But very quickly, teachers cottoned on to the fact that that's what it meant, and the principal, Laura Jones, directed all the kids to wipe it off, take it off. But, of course, she couldn't stop them from putting it on their cars when they were off school property, only when they were on school property. So that's what that acronym was all about.
As we tell this story, I mean, people are thinking about this other narrative similar to this one. Judge Brett Kavanaugh as he's going for the Supreme Court confirmation, and he's been accused of an attempted rape on a high school, one of his contemporaries. Are you seeing echoes here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, Christine Blasey Ford is now saying that she's up for negotiating conditions under which she might testify, and I think, you know, we all need to wait and hear more. And the last I heard, Kavanaugh's team was sort of characterizing it as rough horseplay. What I think, you know, Amber's story demonstrates is that, you know, these incidents, even though they happen when kids are young and even though they're not fully mature and they can certainly be classified as mistakes, they have lifelong ramifications. And I think that's very serious and worthy of a lot of consideration.
This is not something that you could just, you know, shrug off.
Right. In Amber's case, and I think there's been research that shows that, you know, in the opioid epidemic that we're currently going through in the United States, a lot of women who develop opioid addictions are, in fact, victims of sexual assault who are sort of self-medicating for the trauma they've been through. And that was certainly the case with Amber. She had mild addiction issues before her sexual assault, but afterward they absolutely exploded. You know, she developed very, very serious addiction issues that haunted her for years afterward. She's been sober now for about 4 years. She treasures her sobriety, and she's had to work very hard for it because, you know, in part of what she went through in terms of her trauma. And I think that lots of women, in fact, one of the detectives, the sex crimes detectives that I interviewed in the course of writing this article, said to me that she knew of very few women who were incarcerated who didn't have some history of sexual assault. So these issues, they do haunt the victims for a very long time.
What was it like to go back to your old high school and your old community and work on this story? Did people just say, why are you asking these questions?
Yeah, they, you know, why are you bringing this up? This is all, you know, been settled. She made it up anyway. People talked about Amber's reputation. I think a lot of people were especially curious as to why I was interested, because I didn't know her at all or anyone else involved. We were very different kinds of kids. Amber was a sort of popular cheerleader who hung around with athletes. I was in debate and academic decathlon and was a dork. And so it was a little tough. It was a little embarrassing. And I hated to bother people. And it's especially difficult to, you know, kind of aggressively annoy people who know you and know your family. That's just part of the job. And my point was always, you know, all I'm asking for is truth. I'm not bothering you in an interpersonal fashion, and I am certainly not getting any joy out of asking you questions that are personal or difficult. All I'm asking for is the truth.
You expressed on your Twitter account that you were concerned that people thought that you hated Texas, that you didn't want people to think that you had a grudge against your own hometown or your old home state. Why?
Right. Well, I think that, you know, one way that you can read stories like this is a sort of someone who left their state, because I did end up living in Washington, D.C., and I did end up going to college in another state, Massachusetts. One way that you can read stories like this is sort of like, someone who had a bad time in high school, you know, left Texas behind and left football culture and all these things we associate with Texas behind, and now they're kind of taking a run at them. And I don't think that's the case at all. I think this could have happened anywhere. I think this is something that...
It does happen everywhere.
Precisely. I don't think it's at all exclusive to Texas. And I think that Arlington and the North Texas area, they belong just as much to me and Amber as they belong to the people who did this. I don't think that they're the cause of anything bad that happened. And I certainly miss my hometown, and I miss Texas more than anything. And so I tried in the article to get as much at what's beautiful and what's majestic about Texas as what's wrong with some of the culture there. But again, I don't think that the problem with the culture is exclusive to the North Texas area. I think it's all over.
But there is this circle the wagons attitude that many communities have that I read into your story about Amber Wyatt and her story of being raped. And that I think it was Cindy Marks who was the parent who was questioned. And it seemed like she said, well, Amber had a terrible reputation and she was all blah, blah, blah. I don't know what she's talking about. And then, as you write, that she wasn't just doubted. She was hated by her school. It seems you got to wonder about the proportional response to things. Why was their reaction, the faith writing on the wall, the other graffiti that was horrific about her painted on the school wall? Why that reaction?
Well, part of it was this policy that was in place. You know, in 1996, there had been actually another alleged sexual assault of another high school girl at an Arlington high school that had resulted in the institution of what they called the Lynn Hale policy. The Lynn Hale policy had held that if students in the Arlington Independent School District were even found to be at a party where alcohol had been served, they would be banned from their extracurricular activities, including sports or any other athletics, and that means cheerleading, for the remainder of the school year. So even if you weren't drinking, if you were at a party where drinking was taking place, you would be kicked out of football, cheerleading, whatever you were in, for the remainder of the school year. And so that was considered a very, very, very serious, and I guess a lot of parents felt, unfair penalty. And so they fought it, and it was reduced to a 6 weeks penalty. You were just removed for 6 weeks. But even that, by this point in 2006, was felt to be very unfair by kids who participated in football and cheerleading. However, Amber's report triggered an investigation in Martin High School. So all the kids who were found to have been at the party where alcohol was were getting removed from their sports. And I think they were kids taken out of for 6 weeks only, four different athletic events. And so just because of that, that enraged these kids that they ended up, by nature of Amber reporting her assault, they were removed from their sports for 6 weeks. And I think that helped spawn the fury.
And you also have talked about this bloodlust and this effort to control women. That is part of the culture, a culture that some are saying empowered Brett Kavanaugh and the Me Too movement. Why are we allowing these types of things to happen and be permitted by the culture?
Right. Well, why is some level of violence like this, an expectation? I understand in Amber's case and in all cases like this, they're difficult to prosecute. They're difficult to prosecute because the same act can be criminal or not criminal, depending on the mindset of the victim. You know, were they willing or were they unwilling? That's something that, you know, the victim knows and the perpetrator knows, but getting across what the case was to the jury can be more or less difficult. And in this case, I think that, you know, you would have had a difficult trial. Talking to prosecutors who had experience with these kinds of cases, they said, yeah, these cases are difficult to try. Amber's case probably would have been difficult to try. But at the same time, the prosecutors I spoke to who had experience with sex crimes felt like they probably could have gotten a conviction or that at least it was worth taking to trial. And so I feel that there was quite a bit of negligence, on the prosecutorial side, not taking this case to trial, and that if they had, things might have gone differently for Amber.
Elizabeth Brunig is a Washington Post opinion writer. She wrote the piece, What Do We Owe Her Now?, about a high school rape that happened in 2006 in Arlington, Texas, and the resulting cover-up. There is a rich multimedia online presentation of this article. We have a link to it on our website at tpr.org. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. A federal judge ordered Dallas County to stop its practice of automatically using money bail to detain people arrested for misdemeanors and felonies. The judge ruled that the practice is unconstitutional. The ruling resulted from a class action lawsuit brought by a coalition of civil rights organizations. One of the plaintiffs is the Texas Fair Defense Project. Suzanne Pringle is their legal director.
So the judge ruled that a few things. One, that cash bail does not make us safer. and another that conditioning freedom on wealth is illegal. He specifically found that courts cannot automatically detain people on a predetermined money bond, whether a person is charged with a misdemeanor or a felony, and instead that courts must give an opportunity to defendants to be heard on the question of whether or not they can afford bail and must actually consider that information when setting bond and determining release.
The ruling, is this a one of those temporary restraining order type rulings, or this is a lock solid, we got to make changes?
This is a preliminary injunction, and it finds that that plaintiffs are likely to win on the merits of our case. So it's a preliminary injunction, but it has the full force of the law, and it also, for a judge to find that for a judge to issue a preliminary injunction, they have to be sure that they are quite likely to find that plaintiffs are in the right for an eventual injunction. This injunction should put, in addition to requiring that Dallas County in 30 days that they start actually putting in place these practices and they stop holding people automatically on the predetermined money bond, it should put counties across the state on notice that they also need to be, if they haven't already, they need to be reviewing their own pretrial practices and ensuring that they are not using bond schedules and other forms of automatic detention on money bond.
There was a similar ruling in Harris County?
Yes. The most recent situation in Harris County is that the Fifth Circuit has ruled that most of the preliminary injunction is still in place with the same requirements that Judge Godbee ruled on in Dallas County in terms of requiring notice and an opportunity to be heard on the question of whether or not defendants can afford bail and ensuring that the county cannot hold people beyond 48 hours without having that meaningful hearing.
There are people who defend the current bail system, the cash bail system, saying it makes us safer.
Otherwise, and Judge Godbee now in Dallas, and just like Judge Rosenthal before him in Harris County, have found that the evidence shows that cash bail is not any more likely to get someone back into court than release on unsecured financial conditions.
When a person lives in the margins, they're not affluent, they don't have a lot of abundance in their life, being arrested and having to pay bond is sometimes not something that they can actually do. So they end up spending a lot of time in jail, in pretrial detention?
Yep. I mean, people all over our state and all over the country spend days, weeks, and months in jail pretrial because they can't afford bond. That's the travesty of the problem.
And while they sit there, they lose their jobs, they lose their vehicles, they lose their apartments, they lose the relationships sometimes that they depend on. It has a punitive effect.
No, all of that is true. It has a punitive. It does have a punitive effect, even if it shouldn't have a punitive intent. And additionally, folks are much more likely to plead guilty in order to get released on time served. And Judge Godbee also found that to be the case as one of his findings of fact in the Dallas order.
Suzanne Pringle is the legal director for the Texas Fair Defense Project, along with the ACLU and other civil rights organizations. They won a federal court ruling that orders Dallas County to change its cash bail system and its method of pretrial detention. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics shows that Texas leads the nation in job creation, and the unemployment rate in the state is 3.9%. If you're looking for a job, that's encouraging, but if you're looking for workers, not so much. A recent Help Wanted ad in Andrews, Texas, tells the frustration that many employers have. It reads, "Please do not apply if you oversleep, have court often, do not have a babysitter every day, have to get rides, experience flat tires every week, have to hold a cell phone all day to do your work." It goes on. Gary Scout wrote the ad.
We've had a big trouble here in the Permian Basin as a whole, and especially here in Andrews, trying to find quality people. I own a renovation business and roofing company, and there's plenty of oil field workers here, but there's no tradesmen here, and that's the issue.
It seems like you're telling people, get your act together if you want to work for me.
Yes, exactly. And I don't want you late. I don't want you to miss Mondays. Everything listed is the things I've had to tolerate.
You think this is generational, or what do you think?
No, I definitely think it is. It all started with their parents. The children today are not taught work ethic. That's why so many of them are overweight, and they sit in front of the TV all the time. And as far as carpenters, electricians, plumbers, that's all a dying trade. Very few young people want to become a carpenter, a plumber, or electrician.
But you say that you're open to women coming on board.
Yes. We've hired two, as a matter of fact, in the last, three or four weeks.
But and they come ready to work?
Yes. They hadn't missed a day, and they've been here every day with no excuses to go home or whatever.
What kind of reaction have you gotten from this ad? As far as applicants come, are you getting better applicants?
We've had probably six or eight. That's been it. Here in Andrews, I don't know about Odessa Midland, but if I put a wanted ad for help in there and I put must have a driver's license and must pass the drug test, I've done it several times over the years. No one will apply.
That doesn't seem like that big of an ask.
It's not. But so many with these surcharges that the Texas Department of Public Safety has put on so many of these people from, say, 25 to 40, they take their license, and then they can't afford to pay the surcharge, and then they get arrested. And a police officer that we do work for told me it's a vicious circle, around and around and around. The bond's $1,000 to get them out, and then they're driving again without a license. That law has got a lot of flaws in it, in my opinion.
How many people you need to hire?
I'd hire six or eight good ones. I have a lot of subcontractors, and that's how we make it. But I would hire personal employees for the business if they were there. I need some good carpenters and a couple of good painters. We've got work booked up all the way into next year. If work has never been an issue, even when the bust hit here, we only dropped in about 10% in our revenue. So work is not the issue. It's the people.
If someone wanted to turn their life around, I'm sure you'd give them a shot, right?
Yeah, I'll give anybody the benefit of the doubt. Everybody makes a mistake. I mean, all of us, you, me, and I don't even know you. But you can move forward from that, and we've had a couple of people here that have.
Other employers have the same problem?
Oh, I know they do, because I talk to them. I'm a member of the Chamber of Commerce here, and I went down and discussed this issue with them three or four times. And everybody's having this issue. You can tell by the lumber yards here. We've got two of them, and they've got a constant help wanted sign up. I've got one in front of my business that's been up for 4 or 5 years. I'm just not going to tolerate the foolishness that some of these people do here in town on this constantly missing work. Now, if you're in the oil field and you miss work, they fire you. But it's something about this construction business that they've been allowed to not show up or call in sick and come in late. And I'm just, like I say, I'm real frustrated with it. And we've tried hiring through staffing services, the Odessa paper, the Midland paper. I've advertised numerous times here in Andrews. And there's just not anybody out there, not tradesmen.
Gary Scout is the owner of Master Craftsman in Andrews, Texas. He says he's having trouble finding and hiring qualified people who are ready to work. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write on our show page on our website at tpr.org. That's where you can listen to past Texas Matters programs, and you can find us wherever you download your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.